Hello, this is Ron Horshevsky, Executive Director of Agility Orthopedics. I'm joined here by Dr. Christian Anderson, board-certified orthopedic surgeon, and we're here to talk to you today about hip arthroscopy. Welcome, Dr. Anderson.
Hey, morning, Ron.
First of all, let's start with what hip arthroscopy is.
Yeah, hip arthroscopy is a surgical procedure that is typically done as an outpatient. It uses a small tube-type camera about the size of a fountain pen, and it is introduced into the hip joint using a series of small buttonhole-sized punctures through the skin, typically done under general anesthesia in the operating room rather than in the office, but it can be done quite nicely as an outpatient.
When you're having a knee arthroscopy, you're awake, and when you have a hip arthroscopy, you're under general anesthesia. Is that true?
It can be true. The knee arthroscopies can be done several different methods for anesthesia. Typically, the anesthesiologist obviously is in the driver's seat when it comes to electing the best method to manage the patient's health and welfare during the procedure. But in general, we have more options available to us for the knee scope as far as anesthesia goes than we do in the hip. And one reason is that the hip joint itself is much more inaccessible. It has very dense, very tight ligamentous structures that make it much more difficult to obtain entry into the joint with the arthroscope. And so very typically the setup requires a table that has traction built in so we can actually distract that joint a bit to manufacture room enough to put that 4 or 5 millimeter arthroscope in. So the scope itself is about 1/4 inch in diameter. That's how small it is. And the hip joint just barely allows that to pass with that traction applied.
Interesting. Now, how do you know where you're going when you're placing the scope in there?
That's an excellent question. We use surface topography. In other words, there are landmarks on the skin of the patients. The front part of the hip, where your belt hangs, is called the anterior iliac spine. That's an important landmark for us, as well as your hip pointer, which is the greater trochanter. And that's the bump that you feel on the outside of your hip under your side pocket. And those two landmarks are reproducible on every patient. And so whether they're in the supine position, which is lying on their back, or whether they're in the lateral position where they're lying on their side, those bony landmarks are easily palpated, even on folks that are slightly more robust, shall we say. And once we have those surface landmarks outlined, we can then measure up and in from those landmarks to ascertain our starting positions. And then at that point, we then bring in an X-ray machine into the operating room that's designed to work in this situation to guide our instruments into the joint, carefully into the joint. And that also helps us dictate how much traction we need to put on so that we can open the joint sufficiently to get the instruments in without damaging the joint, but not put undue traction on the leg as well.
All right. So what are some of the things that you do when you get in there?
Well, this is really a burgeoning field in arthroscopy, just as the knee was in the 60s and the shoulder was in the early 90s. Our instruments are better, and we're getting more adept at maneuvering around the joint. Typically, the diagnoses that are most appropriate for hip arthroscopy include things like impingement syndrome. There's a syndrome called the CAM, C-A-M, CAM lesion, just like a camshaft in a car. And essentially what happens is the ball shape of the head, which should be a perfect sphere if you think about it, the hip joint has to move through a range of motion that absolutely requires that head to be completely spherical. You cannot have a spherical cup and an egg-shaped head and have it fit perfectly and have that smooth range of motion. And yet some people have a pattern on their bony architecture, even at a young age. You can even see this in teens and 20s, called a CAM lesion. And when they get down, for example, in the four-point position for football players, or the sprinter starting position, they have a great deal of hip flexion. And as they power drive forward, that femur can then actually connect against the cartilage of the rim of the cup, called the labrum, which means lip. It's a cartilaginous material very similar to what's in your nose or your ear. And that fibrocartilage can then tear from that repetitive trauma. And in fact, that is one of the premier areas where arthroscopy of the hip shines, is in managing those injuries, especially in the younger athlete. Taking down that bump on the outer part of the hip to prevent that impingement and dealing with the consequence of that impingement, which is that labral tear.
Interesting. So this is targeted towards a younger population?
In general, it is used in the younger individuals, but we can also use it in some of the older individuals that have some really early degenerative changes and yet are not yet ready to undergo hip replacement. And very typically, they have a degenerative tear of the labrum. I just did one last week. A lady had a loose body in the joint that had sloughed off the top of the head, and ordinarily that would be treated in that circumstance with a replacement, even though the cup was in perfect condition. And so this is an opportunity to really save that woman a large operation and an extended recovery, and potentially buy her another 5 or 10 years before she has to look at that as an option. So it's really a minimally invasive option, even in the older individuals. Now, again, like most surgery, it's not right for everybody. Mm-hmm. One size does not fit all, and that's where a careful examination of the patient's hip, the history is also quite important, and obviously the imaging studies are important too, to come up with the best management of a particular individual. Mm-hmm. But yes, by far the majority of the folks that are going to be the best candidates are going to be those younger individuals that have these issues with the hip. Another popular problem that we use the hip arthroscopic technique for is a snapping hip. We see this in young ladies, especially in their teens and 20s, dancers, gymnasts, and so on. And they'll have a snapping hip that comes from the iliotibial band, which is the psoas tendon, which is the hip flexor of the joint, runs directly over the top part of the femoral head or the ball part of the joint, and that can pop and snap, and it can be very, very disabling. And the arthroscopic treatment of that is extremely straightforward and is really a quick recovery, and they are extremely grateful to have that that irritating snapping mm-hmm. every time they try to get more active athletically handled. So another example, again, not necessarily confined to the youth, but certainly much more common in the youth.
Okay, now what would I expect in terms of recovery if I had this type of a procedure?
Excellent question. The typical patient is on crutches basically for comfort and protection just for a couple of weeks. And the better we get at this, the less time patients are confined. It used to be that you had to be non-weight bearing for 6 weeks. We thought that it took that long for the tissues to heal after being distracted. And now that we have, almost 15 years of experience with hip arthroscopy, now even with a labral repair where the cartilage has literally been repaired back to the bony rim, we still allow weight bearing as tolerated right from the day of surgery, with crutches for protection until they have their protective strength and they lose their limp. It does vary person to person, but in general, most of them are off the crutches and even driving within 3 weeks or so.
And back to sport, if I was an athlete?
Again, depends to some extent on what we're treating them for. If it's a labral tear in a young quad-dependent athlete, such as a football player, hockey, lacrosse, and so on, it could be up to 3 months, because we want to make sure that they have all of their protective strength back before they go back to play and that they have their full painless range of motion back.
Okay. Now, I imagine there's some disadvantages and complications with this procedure that are worth mentioning.
Again, with any surgery, we go to great lengths to make it as safe as possible, but every surgery carries at least a modicum of risk. This is no different. The ones certainly that are reported are traction difficulties from the traction post. Most of the reports that we see are from the early days of hip arthroscopy. Essentially, we would use a standard fracture table, which is not designed to put that much traction on the individual. And so they could easily end up with a nerve bruise around the perineum or, you know, inside their groin, which would give them numbness down the side of their leg. I have never personally seen that happen. We use a table that is specifically designed for hip arthroscopy. It has an extremely large, very well padded post. It distributes those forces quite nicely. And we also keep track of the time that they're under traction. And so we have a stopwatch in the OR specifically for that purpose, mm-hmm. so that we can absolutely limit that time. And if we're still working and we need more time, we'll actually stop, take the traction off, let those tissues recover. And then after a period of time, we'll go ahead and put the traction back on and finish what we're starting.
Okay, great.
So those are probably the ones that are the most common. We do this under fluid environment as opposed to the belly where they use gas. And so there is at least, again, a potential to have fluid kind of exit itself out of the punctures And there are reports, again, I've never seen this happen, but reports of fluid that ends up in the pelvis or in the abdomen, which is saline or Ringer's. It's similar to what goes through your IV.
Mm-hmm.
And by itself, it's not toxic or dangerous, but because it's relatively not warmed, you can have some systemic issues with that. And again, they're reported, they're very, very rare complications, and we have a fluid management system in our hospitals here that allows us to set the pressure of that fluid so that we have very tight control over it. And similarly, the shorter the surgery, the less likely that is to happen. Lastly, the likelihood of a broken instrument. We are using metal instruments. We're very, very careful to be gentle with these instruments. We use a guide wire that's made out of material called nitinol, which is similar to some of the material you see in people's glasses that's very bendable. It has memory and can return to its length. But if you're forcing those instruments occasionally, the nitinol wires can fail. And then it leaves you with a broken wire in the joint, which obviously we can't leave there.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, there is a very, very small incidence of broken instrument that cannot be successfully retrieved through the scope and occasionally ends up to an incision in the hip to take it out.
Okay, so when you're talking about pressure, fluid pressure in the joint, you're talking about basically a medium for you to look through, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yep,
and then,
just like looking through a fish tank.
Now, is that the same thing they use in the shoulder and the knee? Or
absolutely.
It's a fluid, so it's the exact same thing.
It's the exact same setup.
Okay.
And again, we have years and years and years of experience, yeah, dealing with that fluid management system in the shoulder and the knee. We want to use just enough pressure that we can visualize the structures, but not so much that we're going to force that fluid out into the periphery.
Okay, now are there needs for physical therapy after a procedure like this?
Again, the length required varies individual to individual, but like with most orthopedic surgery, the physical therapy is really an integral part of the recovery. And I consider that part of our surgical outcome, clearly, is the physical therapy and that tight integration with the therapist and the physician after the fact. So I think, again, the length of time may vary person to person in terms of the number of visits they require. But in general, virtually everyone is going to require at least some physiotherapy postoperatively to regain their motion and strength after the surgery.
Okay. Any contraindications or precautions after the procedure? You said basically weight bearing is tolerated, mm-hmm, and they can just gradually go back to their activities. So there's nothing significant lost.
Nothing significant. Occasionally, again, on some of the older individuals that already have some difficulties with hip stiffness and so on, they occasionally will need to use some just general activities of daily living, accessories such as raised toilet seats. Not sitting on a low stool or a low chair, they may have to be elevated just because they don't have that arc of motion to be able to get in and out.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously using their crutches or walker or cane to level out their pelvis. What we don't like to see is people really limp after surgery, because that throws the rest of them out of alignment. So if you have a arthritis of the spine or a degenerative disc issue that's been asymptomatic or quiescent, then having you limp after the surgery, whether it's from your knee or your ankle or your hip, can stimulate those symptoms of sciatica and so on. And so we want to avoid that. We want to make sure that we have your limp effectively isolated and treated, and that essentially involves getting that balance and strength of your core back.
Okay, great. Is there anything else you'd like to add about the procedure that we haven't mentioned?
No, I think really the only other thing is that we have really some of the latest equipment on the market. The
mm-hmm.
The equipment we're using currently is less than a year old, and it's high definition, just like watching TV. It's just beautiful, and it gives us a really staggeringly beautiful picture of the hip joint. And it's like most things, I look at this from where I started in orthopedics back in 1982, and I go, how far we've come.
Wow.
As my original arthroscope did not have a camera on it, and so you had to look through a little eyepiece like looking through a point-and-shoot camera.
Oh, yeah.
Way back in
Wow.
the 60s. And to learn, they had a piece that extended it like a periscope, so both of you were standing on your head trying to figure out what you were looking at upside down. So we've come a very long way.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Anderson, thank you very much.
My pleasure.